All right. Let's get fired up here.
Maximum freedom. Read.
Stay on target.
Maximum.
Stay on target.
Maximum. Read Rothbard.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Read Rothbard. My name is Daniel, and with me, as always, is Robert Johnson. How are you, Robert?
Yeah, one correction. This is actually the Read Rothbard podcast, so that would be weird. But yeah, hey, I'm doing great. Loving life. Trying to walk off a sleeping leg.
Yeah, so we are, in fact, real people. Our legs also fall asleep.
In case you were wondering.
Hey, we're not robots. I mean, that'd be cool and all.
We might make it to the robotic revolution. We'll see.
Yeah, and I mean, I guess that means we'd like always have a job, right? Because robots are taking away the jobs of everyday Americans. Quote unquote.
Well, they are actually. Human beings, low skilled labor, are being priced out of jobs. Minimum wage is being raised up past the point of their productivity. And business owners are being given false economic messages to mechanize early. But yeah, what you said.
Exactly. So this is not a minimum wage robotics automation show today. This one is going to be a little bit more on the Matrix, and I did say moron, so you can expect really great arguments out of us today. But first, a little bit of housekeeping. We are getting up there in the number of shows in regards to how much we can have hosted at any one time at Podomatic, where we host our podcasts. So our solution is, rather than pay, because we don't have a whole lot of funds coming in for the show, for the website at the moment, we are going to archive shows. So we're going to have a rotation on the site or on Podomatic of like, you know, a dozen or so, however many will fit at any given time. And then anything older will start to fall off of Podomatic and then be only hosted at readrothbard.com. So if you do find our show and enjoy it and you do want to go back and see our humble beginnings, and they are humble, quite, you can do so at readrothbard.com. Any thoughts on that one, Robert?
I'm all for it. I'm a big pro-archivist.
I think that'll be good.
Fantastic.
Another tidbit of information I want to mention is we have launched the Maximum Freedom logo items. So there's a hoodie, some T-shirts, and a, what do you call it, a tank top, wife beater, whatever, you know, sleeveless T-shirt style?
Yeah, that's like a sleeveless tank or something, maybe, I guess you could call it.
Yeah, and my wife said that she would actually wear that one if I order it, so I might do that because she's been working out, you know, so she wants to show off those guns.
Sick.
So those are on the website as well. They're pretty cool looking. They use some of that artwork that was inspired by one of our previous shows where we said we're not for left or right, we're for maximum freedom, and I think that that's a good message to get out in the world, and it does look like a WWF/WWE logo. So if you couple that with our podcast intro music, and then, you know, go to your next summer barbecue sporting both of those, like blast our music, and then make your entrance, you will be pretty badass.
I mean, you'll be badass anyway, but you'll just be upping the badassness because you're believe in freedom, so you're already super badass.
But you also get shot down by so many people. Oh, my God. That's going to be later in the show, but that's a little bit of a, what do you call that, a forewarning?
Teaser.
Teaser. Dick tease. I'm sorry. Just tease. and then the other thing I wanted to mention regarding the housekeeping items is I have loaded a bunch of stuff for Wednesday publication about Murray Rothbard books, and they have the Amazon links. So the idea being that you can be notified of a book that's relevant to that period of time and purchase it so it will arrive to you in time for the weekend. So just in case you do want to read a 900-page economic book, you can order it Wednesday and get it delivered by Friday by clicking through the Amazon link and ordering via Prime or on your Kindle device, and it'll be delivered instantaneously.
Yeah, good stuff.
I know, totally exciting, totally exciting. So, as I said at the very beginning, we did want to touch a little bit more on The Matrix, which was our previous show. During the editing and post-processing process, to be redundant, I did come up with additional things I wanted to talk about. And one of them was in relation to Jeremy Bentham, who is a 1800s philosopher, economist, who many people look fondly upon because he basically justifies the use of the state to achieve the ends. You know, he's a very utilitarian type person. And so what I'll do is I'll play a clip from Murray, which is almost 7 minutes long, where he talks about Bentham, utilitarianism, and one of the nefarious devices that he intended to use to achieve his ends. So I'm going to play that now.
Yeah, well, Bentham was a Smithian, started off life as a Smithian, devoted Smithian. He wrote a very good, his only good book, I think, is Defense of Usury, in which he attacked Smith for selling out on the usury question. He wrote that in the 1790s when he was a devoted Smithian. Bentham, of course, was not the founder, but probably the big systematizer of utilitarianism, a bitter opponent of natural rights, natural law, whatever. When you have to cut through the Benthamite movement, a whole bunch of Benthamites around, you cut through, you find the real core of Benthamism, which is pretty monstrous. And of course, Bentham really is the founder of modern economics, a sense of welfare economics, cost-benefit analysis. It all comes in with Bentham. These people, James Mellon and John Stuart Mill, are essentially Benthamites, and bring in the Benthamite, replacing whatever natural law doctrine there was. And I think it's all fallacious. I mean, the personal utilitarianism is fallacious, and certainly social utilitarianism, where you try to add up personal utilities and personal benefits and figure out what the maximum general greatest good for the greatest number is. It's obvious, to me, obvious nonsense. You can't add them up, since all utilities are subjective and ordinal. Bentham's famous phrase, the greatest good for the greatest number, which is sort of the cornerstone of his doctrine. One of the problems with that, of course, one of the many problems, is what if, supposing you're in the lesser number, then what? What happens then? Utilitarianism can justify almost everything. I think Benthamites would admit this. In other words, since there's no justice, no such thing as natural rights, justice, or anything else, it's all manipulating everything for alleged cost-benefit arguments. For example, take the idea, say, on punishment theory, which is an arcane part of libertarian doctrine. The Benthamites, of course, pure deterrence theorists. They don't believe in justice. It's all deterrence. Well, deterrence doesn't have to, for example, to deter. Take, for example, this sort of situation. Most people don't want to commit murder for whatever reason. They don't like it. They're against it. They're reluctant to commit murder. On the other hand, a lot of people are willing to steal an apple from a push cart or from a fruit store. Therefore, according to pure deterrence theory, punishment for murder should be very light, and punishment for apple stealing should be capital punishment, preferably in public, to make an example of a stealer. And most of us think there's something wrong with this. It's what the philosophers call counterintuitive. Or it was nutso. most of us have a view of justice, even if we don't have an articulated theory of it. Bentham throws that all out. Benthamites also in favor, example, of punishing the innocent. Execute the innocent, provided the public doesn't know they're innocent. If the public thinks they're guilty, it's good enough, right? Why not? And no moral principles and whatever. What I want to talk about with Bentham is the panopticon, which is the key to his thought, which Benthamites don't like to talk about. This is Bentham's great project. He's a great projector. He wrote millions of words, much of which, fortunately, have not been published yet. He had a fleet of secretaries, very wealthy, aristocrat, and so he had employed secretaries to take them down, copy them. There was no, of course, Xerox machine or typewriter at that epoch. He was sort of a living reductio ad absurdum of his own. His panopticon was a living reductio ad absurdum of his own thought. He used to be a Tory. He was a Tory aristocrat. He converted to democracy, actually converted by James Mill, because the Tories wouldn't adopt his doctrine, his panopticon. He figured nothing could be worse than that. Maybe a democracy will adopt my panopticon. Panopticon was a theory which Benthamite apologists claim only applied to prisons. It did not apply only to prisons. There's an excellent, very amusing article. There's a lot of good stuff. Douglas Long has a book called Bentham and Liberty, a very good scholarly work. Gertrude Himmelfarb, usually not one of my favorite people, being a neoconservative, has an excellent critique of Bentham called The Haunted House of Jeremy Bentham and her book on Victorian minds. Panopticon was a scheme not just for the prisoner, for almost everybody, for the poor, for children, for vagrants. I mean, everybody would be rounded up. It's been estimated by Bentham himself that from a third to two-thirds of the population would be incarcerated in panopticons, which were essentially compulsory concentration camps. It was nice with scientifics, there's no such thing as justice or privacy. It's all cost-benefit, right? You maximize surveillance. And so you have one guy sitting in the center of a circle, and all the prisoners and kids and whatever you want, paupers, all lined up so you can see into them. And of course, this was before the age of television and all that. Brilliant prophecy of the Orwellian future. Even though you couldn't see everybody every time, nobody would know when you're seeing them, so everybody would feel he's under surveillance. That's when fellows are utilitarian. It's very important for everybody to feel at all times he's under surveillance by Big Brother, okay, by the Panopticon leadership. And so this would keep them, not only keep them on the straight and narrow, keep them working to the maximum. You want to get maximum production out of them. Let's see, 12 and a half hours a day at forced labor and so forth and so on. And have everything beautifully worked out. The idea, of course, to have maximum production by these slave labor, which is essentially what it was. Panopticon, by the way, is Greek for all seeing. That's the controller who sees everything. So like the old Big Brother. Also, inspection house was another way to put it. This is a big reform. Himmelfarb puts it very neatly. He said Bentham by this time was an atheist. She says Bentham did not believe in God, but he did believe in the qualities apotheosized by in God. The Panopticon was a realization of the divine ideal, spying out the ways of the transgressor, or potential transgressor, by means of an ingenious architectural scheme, turning night into day with artificial light and reflectors, holding men captive by an intricate system of inspection. The Panopticon becomes omniscient and omnipotent, omnipresence of the inspector. This, of course, makes things most efficient for the goals of the inspectors. At one point, Bentham says there might be some drawing back to adopt my scheme because it might be said that these people become robots instead of people. He might be, as he says, productive of an imbecility. So the formerly free man would no longer, in a deep sense, be fully human. And he asks himself whether the result of his heroic contrivance might not be constructing a set of machines out of the similitude of men. And to this critical question, he says, he gives a utilitarian reply, brutal, brusque, and utilitarian. Namely, who cares? Who cares if they're just machines? The only real question is, would happiness be most likely to be increased or diminished by this discipline? Of course, he being a scientist of happiness could answer the question very neatly. Namely, as he said, they'll be happy almost by definition. Call them soldiers, call them monks, call them machines, he says. So they were but happy ones, I should not care. As Isabel Patterson would call the humanitarian with a guillotine or the slave pen. So economy and productivity were what he was trying to maximize. As he put it, industry is a blessing. 7.5 hours a day was enough for sleep, an hour and a half total for meals, the rest of the time they were working, a forced labor regime. Now, the punchline of this whole thing, the whole Panopticon scheme, is that he would run it, and it would be a private property, privately owned Panopticon, giant Panopticon, slave labor would be owned by him. He meant them. We get to extract the profits from the slave laborers. And this way we have a unity of private and public institutions. And so he tried to lobby in Parliament, lobby the court, and never get it through, fortunately for Great Britain.
Well said, Murray. What do you think of that, Robert?
Murray knows stuff. Murray is on top of all kinds of stuff. If you get into all the breadth of knowledge that dude had, it's quite impressive. But what he was talking about, we will apply to at least one other thing. The whole utilitarian idea, and as I believe he states, can be used to explain or justify nearly anything. If you don't have any kind of moral backing, you can use utilitarianism to justify whatever you want. I mean, Hitler was perfectly justified in murdering however many people because he thought it would make a better world for his Jews or his Germans. He wasn't making any kind of principled argument. He was only making a utilitarian argument. And human beings make utilitarian arguments all the time, which is why they make sense to us. You know, I'm hungry, so I'm going to go eat some food. That's a purely utilitarian thing to do. I like this person, so I'm going to hang out with this person. I see some benefit from X, Y, and buying this product or that product. I mean, these are all utilitarian things we do. So we're oriented that way. And when you're doing it yourself, and you're making decisions for yourself, that's perfectly fine. I got no issue with that. But when you start using utilitarian arguments to expand or to, you know, as a part of a power over another person, you're making utilitarian arguments for other people. And using violence to enact those utilitarian arguments, that's where you run into issue with me. And that's why moral arguments will always be superior, especially when you're talking about, you know, should I or should I not do X in regards to another person. Because utilitarianism will say, well, does it benefit you to murder this guy or not? Well, then go ahead and murder that guy if it benefits you. You know, do crunch the numbers. Decide if it's good or not to murder that person, go ahead. So, yes, we are wired that way. But without a moral philosophical backing. We're just creatures in search of, like, pleasure. Not that that's an entirely bad thing, but when you're talking about attacking other people and using other people's time and money and livelihoods, you need some sort of a moral grounding, because otherwise you get things like the state, and you get all the horrors that are entailed from that, hundreds of millions dead and counting.
Yeah, it's quite amazing that people still support something that has been the second leading cause of death in history, you know, other than old age, I guess.
Not only support it, but vehemently defend it against even the mildest of criticisms.
Yeah, and that's something we'll touch on in a little bit. I was curious how you felt that bit from Murray about Bentham, and he talks about the panopticon. So leaving aside those other arguments for a little bit later, but specifically the panopticon, that's what reminded me of the Matrix and why I wanted to bring it up because of our last show. And so how do you see that relating to how people are in the pods and they believe what they're shown and all of those types of things?
For me, it mostly paralleled the idea that you're constantly being watched, or you're possibly being watched. You didn't know when or how. The idea that, like today, you it's not really known exactly what kind of surveillance we are under at all, any and all times. I mean, like in Utah, the NSA built some giant, like, basically a giant warehouse full of a million, like, hard drives, and supposedly it's said to store all the data of all the internet traffic of everything and everywhere till it fills up, apparently. I don't know. I guess it's going to have enough space, or it does have enough space for it to last a long time. And then if they could turn on any number of systems to listen and watch you at any given time, it's just a matter of, I guess, manpower and desire. But the idea of having your prisoners constantly under surveillance, even if they, or even them believing that they're under surveillance or not, makes your job a whole lot easier as a jailer, because you don't have to do as much work. You could watch every once in a while. The idea of the panopticon was just to have one guy be able to watch hundreds of prisoners. It's just a giant circle, basically. And it was stacked up. So just imagine, like, 10 donuts stacked up, like a big round building, and have one guard in the middle of the donut. And he could just turn his head, essentially, or spin around in his chair and watch any number of hundreds of prisoners at any given time. That's a huge time and money saver if you were a state.
How so utilitarian of them.
Incredibly utilitarian. So, you know, it's even gotten to the point where does the NSA and the government and whatever, do they even really need to build these horrific surveillance systems? Or could you just leak a couple stories about that they have these horrific surveillance systems to get the same desired effect? Now, I'm sure they love using them and having them. I mean, it's not their money. What do they care? And they get to turn them on whenever they want. So it's not necessarily that everybody's being watched all the time, but if they wanted to watch somebody or listen to somebody at any given time, they could. And then there's also the idea that keyword software is running constantly, and if certain keywords are triggered, then the computer starts listening, like recording, and flags it for human analysis. So, you know, how much of those things are true? Well, I think a lot of it's been admitted, but the end result, or the message here, the lesson here is that just the idea of you may be under surveillance does affect your behavior. It does keep the slaves in line, so to speak. And it ties right into the Matrix.
Yeah, it also sounds like it would be similar to 1984, you know, the telescreens, which he can, you know, they can see him, they can tell him to do his morning workouts and chide him for not doing it hard enough or whatever it is that they do in that movie.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, he's not doing it, but bends as well as he should, so the lady yells at him. Oh, yeah.
Thirty to 40 group, take your places, please. Right. Let's see which one of us can touch his toes. Right over from the hips, brothers and sisters, please. One. Two, One, two. One, two. One, two. Smith? 6079 Smith W? Yes, you. Bend lower. You're not trying. Watch me. There, brother. That's what I want. Anyone under 45 is perfectly capable of touching his toes. I'm 39 and I've had 4 children. We don't all have the privilege of fighting in the front line. Remember our boys on the Malabar front. Just think what they have to put up with.
Yeah, yeah. I like the Orwell quote that you want a vision of the future? Just imagine a boot stepping on a head or a skull forever.
Yeah, that reminds me. There's a meme out there that has two, like, army boots or whatever, and out of each boot is a head of Trump or Clinton, and it says, so which boot do you prefer on your neck?
Yeah, it's good. It's good. Which leads us, if you want to move on to the next bit, but it does lead on us on to the your Eric Peters article, if you want to talk about that.
Yeah, let's do that. You got a little summary of that article? And the argument you're making?
Do you want to move on from the Matrix, or do you?
Yeah, we can. I just wanted to touch on the Matrix regarding the Panopticon because it was one of the things I thought of when we were doing the show and had not brought up at the time.
Well, no, let's move on from the Matrix with the idea that in the Matrix, let's transition to the Facebook talk, because in the Matrix, Morpheus specifically tells Neo that anybody who hasn't been saved, who hasn't been shown the Matrix for what it is, anybody still stuck in the program, not only will be just living their lives and whatever, but they will actually actively, vehemently defend the system that they're in. And that is directly analogous to what you see anytime any kind of anarchist or freedom lover or anything even mildly criticizes the state. So if you go on Facebook and you'll see some statists post, and they're not hard to find, they're all over the place. But what is hard to find is any kind of criticism of the statist post, because anytime there's any kind of response, it gets attacked big time. Even the slightest of criticisms of the state. Like, don't you think that, you know, maybe it's a little bit wasteful doing this, blah, blah, blah. Just massive attacking from all over the place, from all people. And this creates a chilling effect. It doesn't necessarily convince anybody, the person who posted it, that their post was wrong. But it creates a chilling effect for anybody else who is going to possibly post an equally freedom-based message, or even, hopefully, one more concrete, foundationally freedom-based. So, I don't know if you want to talk specifics, but you sent me a specific post. But these are all over the place. Not hard to find. But do you have it? What happened to my thing? I got switched off. Here we go. Daniel?
Yes, sir?
Should I be naming names here? What do you think?
No, I think let's not name the names, but we can talk the arguments.
Okay.
And I think similar to what you're alluding to, there's also a chilling effect in the idea that you could be being watched at any time. So that also is a chilling effect, but I think the point you're making is that if people are so inured into the system as it is, they will go to any ends to defend it.
Do we have a deal, Mr. Reagan?
You know, I know this steak doesn't exist. I know that when I put it in my mouth, the Matrix is telling my brain that it is juicy and delicious. After 9 years, you know what I realize? Ignorance is bliss.
Then we have a deal.
I don't want to remember nothing. Nothing. You understand? And I want to be rich. Someone important. Like an actor.
Whatever you want, Mr. Reagan.
And so therefore, the state doesn't actually have to have that panopticon, if you will. They can just have enough people believing in the same system to where they will police the outliers themselves.
Yeah, and the prisoners will police the prisoners. Absolutely.
Exactly. And so that's kind of what we're talking about with this Facebook post. And let's just talk in generalities about it. But essentially, a person that I know posted a note about a tax holiday. So it's like a weekend in which there's no sales tax, and it's a statewide thing in the state that they live in. And I guess you were telling me that this is a thing in about 12 other states or 12 states total.
Yeah.
And it's an effort to not lose revenue for the state, because a lot of times people will cross state lines to make their larger purchases, and they figure if they have a tax holiday weekend, then those sales will stay within the state, whatever. I mean, it's totally arbitrary. You know, it's a weekend that you don't get screwed over or whatever, you know, which is kind of bullshit to begin with. But his idea was, hey, instead of having this tax holiday thing, what if we just diverted those funds on this particular weekend towards something great like education? And I'll let you take it from there, Robert.
Well, and he means government education. But so then, as you can imagine, there are probably like 90% comments pro, this is a great idea, these are all fantastic, you know, teachers are underpaid, blah, blah, blah. Well, fantastic, you should run for president, you're the best. But then there is one guy, actually two people, who kind of are like, why would we make money on this government system that's completely broken? And he's talking about the educational system. And then he gets totally attacked. He says that why should we make more money on the broken system? And he goes, hashtag teach your own. And then the status is like, well, but I want a well-rounded child. Having me as a teacher would be terrible, because I'm terrible at teaching my own kid. And apparently, I don't know exactly what hashtag teacher own is. Do you have any more insight on that? But he rebounds with, you think that's what that is?
Well, I think anytime you put a hashtag on something, it doesn't necessarily need to be a thing in particular, but you're sort of like suggesting that it should be. You know what I mean? Like you're... It's a form of emphasis, if I understand the Twitter world properly.
Okay. So anyway, our larger point, I guess we don't really need to get into specifics, is, but just that this is a very slight criticism of the state, that admitting that the education system is broken and inefficient and all this is just a very slight criticism. And then there's all this backlash against this guy that...
Don't they say shit like, it's your civic duty to pay taxes, and as a Christian, you should be supporting your fellow man, and I can't believe that you don't see it this way, and you're totally ridiculous, and if you don't like it, then just move somewhere. You can live in a different state and, you know, or different country, and even though you might not be as comfortable, it's one of the things you have to do to live here, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, the argument that taxes are a civic duty and that you can always leave as if you have any positive obligation to do that. You own the property that you live on, assuming, or your landlord does, but the government doesn't. So the idea that you need to leave your owned area in order to not be stolen from is obviously false. And then saying that you could just move to another place, well, name a place that isn't just another tax farm, there isn't some central planning bureaucrat with the whip just waiting for you to show up. I mean, that doesn't exist. These people have these ideas of what countries are and what they should be and ought to be, especially the liberals. They seem to think that, you know, education is a basic human right and Medicare and medical attention is a basic human right, and that it is the job and responsibility of a country, whatever that is, that's just a concept, but apparently it's a thing, to do these things. So, I mean, if you believe that medical attention and education is a basic human right, then I guess that you're saying that everybody else is a slave to you and must provide the service for you. The argument breaks down almost immediately, but it doesn't stop it from being made constantly. I mean, it's always just stated. But that's what you expect from Facebook posts. I mean, it's just a bunch of statements. There's never really cogent argument. Taxes are part of living in most first world nations. Well, does that mean it's legitimate? It's true, but you're saying it as if it's just a fact. And it is, but it's like saying that taxes are a part of living in most first world nations as if, see, it's a good idea. Everybody does it.
Yeah, I mean, what'd your parents tell you when you were growing up? Like, if everyone else was jumping off a bridge, would you do it? You know? It's not an argument.
Yeah, it's not an argument. But you don't go to Facebook, Statebook, for cogent arguments. So, in a sense, we're going after the low-hanging fruit here. But it's a good to point out just that if you even mildly criticize the state, you will be attacked by these statist defenders who are your fellow prisoners. And they think, you know, they're kind and considerate and caring and compassionate people, but they advocate violence and force be used against you and theft to be used to pay for systems that they think are fantastic. I mean, the Panopticon guy, he's an advocate of greatest good for greatest number of people, but and that state and welfare is fantastic for that. And as we have said all along, we don't make this point every episode, but all you have to do is listen to a guy like Walt Williams or Tom Sowell talk about how if you want more poverty, you just substitute, or you subsidize poverty. You pay for the things you want more of. Welfare doesn't lift people out of poverty, even though poverty is it's a moving goalpost, and it's just in relation to other people at all times. But just giving people money, much like the guaranteed basic income crowd ideas, doesn't have the effect that you want it to have. It's actually, you would think getting a bunch of free money would be a great thing. It doesn't lead you to be more productive. If you have, I mean, can you imagine the most productive trust fund baby? I can't imagine. Those people would have no incentive to produce, no incentive to work. So what are you even talking about? That, anyway, any ideas, Daniel?
Well, I do like his final comment back to these people who are attacking him. And he's, you know, like, oh, so taxes are somehow, what does he say, like a civic duty, you know, sarcasm. You know, just because the taxes that you pay get funding towards something that you support doesn't make you a benevolent person. It doesn't mean that you actually care. And his point there is the point we've made before, where if somebody assumes that the government is taking care of some problem, you know, problem X or Y, then they'll be less likely to, you know, contribute to charities or do other things that would help that situation because they assume it's already been taken care of, already paying for it, et cetera.
Right. Right. Support the things you support by supporting them directly. Putting all your money in the basket and giving it to the government to distribute as it sees fit. You're a much better spender of your own money than the government ever will be.
Yeah, indeed. I mean, like Murray was saying in that quote earlier, value is subjective and it can't be measured. So, you know, that utilitarian argument breaks down. And the whole idea of somebody else knowing better than you what's good for you, maybe it plays in the someone who knows you directly and is offering you advice, or, you know, say your parents or whatever, and or somebody who's been through some experience and so they know what it's like. But in a political world or a political realm, it doesn't play out that way. You know, it's the tyranny of the majority making decisions for everybody, even the people who abstain from voting or who vote against whatever it is you're supporting. And I guess that can bring up our whole the Eric Peters article about voting, and he's arguing it is in a defensive way, if you're ready to move in that direction.
Sure, I'd just like to add in that, yes, because laws are not suggestions. Laws are not advice. Laws are commands and backed up by violence. So it's a huge difference when you go from the personal realm to the political realm. Now, the Eric Peters Auto, on ericpetersauto.com, it's called A Big Goddamned Difference, posted on the 5th. And there is now currently 120 comments. This is being thoroughly discussed, but not the comments I read were disappointing. But anyway, this is one. Eric is written by Eric, so this is his website and this is his big post. And a This basically is a huge pragmatic argument for voting for Donald Trump. In the past, Eric is a very freedom-oriented guy. He's basically making the argument that Hillary is a murderer. That's undeniable. She's a mass murderer. Sure. That's perfectly, I mean, most politicians are. But he's saying that since Hillary's a murderer, and Trump is an unconfirmed murderer, or at least he hasn't killed anybody yet, then you have to vote for Hillary. And he gets into it. There's a bunch of facts and a bunch of things that he says.
You mean against Hillary, right?
What did I say?
You said for, but I mean, you know, what fucking difference does it make? Which I think was her quote regarding the Benghazi thing, so it's appropriate.
Oh, really? Is that what she said? No, it doesn't surprise me.
What difference does it make at this point anyhow, I think was her quote, about, you know, the guys who got killed
right
from that situation?
I'm sure they probably don't mind getting murdered.
Information developing? Was the situation fluid? Would we reach conclusions later that weren't reached initially?
Madam Secretary, do you disagree with me that a simple phone call to those evacuees to determine what happened wouldn't have ascertained immediately that there was no protest? I mean, that was a piece of information that could have been easily obtained.
Well, but Senator,
within hours, if not days.
Senator, when you're in these positions, the last thing you want to do is interfere with any other process it's the fact. Number two, I would recommend highly you read both what the ARB said about it and the classified ARB, because even today there are questions being raised. Now, we have no doubt they were terrorists, they were militants, they attacked us, they killed our people. But what was going on and why they were doing what they were doing?
We were misled that there were supposedly protests and then something sprang out of that, an assault sprang out of that. And that was easily ascertained that was not the fact.
But the American
people could have known that within days, and they didn't know that.
With all due respect, the fact is we had 4 dead Americans. Was it because of a protest, or was it because of guys out for a walk one night who decided they'd go kill some Americans? What difference at this point does it make? It is our job to figure out what happened and do everything we can to prevent it from ever happening again, Senator. Now, honestly, I will do my best to answer your questions about this, but the fact is that people were trying in real time to get to the best information. The IC has a process, I understand, going with the other committees to explain how these talking points came out. But, you know, to be clear, it is, from my perspective, less important today, looking backwards, as to why these militants decided they did it than to find them and bring them to justice. And then maybe we'll figure out what was going on in the media.
So anyway, he's basically saying that Hillary is an established murderer. Trump is an unknown quantity in that respect. Therefore, defensively, I'm going to vote for Trump. And so my comments are, A, this is one giant pragmatic argument. B, he's taking basically what their campaign slogans are and what they say in their campaign speeches and their actions too. I mean, to be fair, but he's saying that based on that, for certainty, more people will die. With Trump, they may not. So he's making this pragmatic argument that, you know, 1,000,001 people are going to die if you elect Clinton, and only 1,000,000 die if you elect Trump. So he's making a value judgment based on the number of people that are going to die.
How utilitarian of him.
It's incredibly utilitarian. It's probably one of the better arguments, saying that I believe that I may personally die. Therefore, it is my personal self-defense action to vote for Trump. And if you believe that, fine. I can't sit here and say you're wrong. But his argument is based on conjecture. He doesn't know, and he's taking the word of known liars. All they do is lie. So how you can take anything they say to be true of what they're actually going to do once they get into office is a joke. And since his argument essentially hinges on that, I discount it. Add into the fact that your vote really doesn't count anyway. I mean, I don't really want to get into the whole voting shenanigans thing, but it's essentially, your vote is essentially meaningless. But whatever. So that's why my feelings on this argument. If he's convinced that more people are going to die under Hillary, then sure. Go ahead. But every vote is a request for subjugation. Every vote legitimizes the system. Every vote is saying, hey, I choose you to be my overlord. It's a disgusting act. And yes, I understand that we live on a prison planet. There's nowhere you can really go without some overlord holding the whip. And you want to be, there's an obvious desire to be whipped less as opposed to whipped more.
To borrow a Walter Block argument.
Right. But I would just say, stare the whipmaster in the face and say, you have no right to whip me whatsoever. I grant you no authority over me. You have no legitimate reason to exist here. You have no legitimate reason to attack me. You are trash. You're human garbage. And I'm not going to legitimize your trashy behavior and say you're doing anything in any way correct or moral. I am super hesitant to even give them the slightest bit of encouragement in what they do. What they do is run around and attack people all day and claim, like, to be fantastic and get lauded and praised and have people bow and scrape before them and call them sir and ma'am and all this horrific, disgusting behavior. And they're thugs. They're thugs that go around stealing and attacking people all the time. So to have anybody vote for them to say, yes, I want this person being my ruler, that's just disgusting. It's absolutely disgusting. I mean, why not go to the mafia, the local mafia don, and be like, please be my thug protection racket guy, please? Could you expand into my area? Because you're not, your local thugs that are running around and demanding protection money haven't come to my store yet. or I'm being ruled by some other mafia thug guy. Could you come over and rule me instead? The act is disgusting. So I find it personally repugnant. But if you really think that you're going to get killed because one person over another, then I really can't blame you for voting defensively, I suppose. But it violates my principles, and I won't do it myself personally. I'd say let the thugs be a thug and show them for the thugs that they are and expose them. And let they need to be shown to be the disgusting thugs that they are, or else they're just going to be encouraged to keep doing it. Anyway, those are my comments. What do you got, Daniel?
Yeah, I don't disagree with you. I mean, when I read the article and sent it to you, I was like, hey, you know, is this appealing in any way? And you were like, well, no, not really. And I said, well, what if he felt it was an imminent threat and therefore he was voting defensively, you know, in self-defense? But to your point, he is assuming a pretense of knowledge based on information he's gathering from two known liars or a whole system that perpetuates lies, you know, like those who lie the best and lie the most rise to the top and gain that power, that position of power, that ring of power from our Lord of the Rings episode.
Uh-huh.
And to base your decisions on something that you know you can't rely upon and assume that you know which one's going to be worse is really no way to really know and no reason to abandon your principles. And so I'll point to a Robert Wenzel article, I think it's on Target Liberty, where Walter Block actually sends this Eric Peters article to Wenzel and is like, hey, is this convincing? And Wenzel's like, hey, you know, to argue that Trump is less likely to get us into war, you know, what about this comment about he wants to put 30,000 troops to fight ISIS? Or he cites a couple of other examples, and I'll have the article down below. But he's basically saying, like, based on what they've said, both of them are going to be terrible. And so his argument is, Wenzel's argument is, I don't support either of these people. They're both terrible. You can't believe anything they're going to say. But the thing that scares him the most is charisma, in that Clinton doesn't have very much charisma. She's not going to get a whole stadium of people going fired up about any given issue. But Trump has some charisma and can get some naive people to follow him. And so he'll liken that to a Mussolini or a Hitler being able to rile up the masses.
In uns selbst allein liegt die Zukunft des deutschen Volkes. Wenn wir selbst dieses deutsche Volk Vorführen durch eigene Arbeit, durch eigenen Fleiß, eigene Entschlossenheit, eigenen Trotz, eigene Beharrlichkeit, dann werden wir wieder emporsteigen, genau wie die Väter einst auf Deutschland nicht geschenkt erhielten, sondern selbst nicht schaffen mussten.
And therefore, he could be considered a greater threat as far as getting what he seeks to accomplish done versus Hillary, who, you know, maybe she wants to do more growth of the state type things, but she'll be less effective at getting them done. So that's my comments on that. Do you have any thoughts there?
Just that's also a pragmatic argument. And it seems like if you wanted to argue pragmatic arguments, you could do it all day long. And in fact, with the hundreds of comments, or over 120, 130 comments that it's sitting at right now, that is all the comment section. It's just pragmatic back and forth. Well, I think Trump because X, Y, and Z. I think Clinton because X, Y, and Z. And never the twain shall meet. It seems really pointless and a waste of time.
Well, to be fair, though, Wenzel's not saying that he supports either one. He's just saying, based on the charisma factor, not what they say they're going to do, that he thinks things will be worse with Trump because he can get more accomplished. So it's not necessarily a pragmatic thing. He's not saying he supports either one. He's just prognosticating based on his assessment of the situation. Does
right.
that still seem pragmatic?
And if I had to make a pragmatic argument, and it is pragmatic, but if I had to make a pragmatic argument, yes, I would follow Murray's pragmatic argument, which is, let's get every stupid retard in the government you can. If people, his actual quote is people who can't find a doorknob. That's who I want in government. I want people that don't know to do anything. And in fact, there's a good argument for getting the most corrupt people possible in, just because they'll sit around and try and get graft all day, as opposed to actually passing legislation. But corrupt people also pass horrific legislation, so I don't know if I subscribe to that. But you definitely want less to be done in government, because all they do, I mean, their jobs literally are to craft laws, to pass legislation. That is their job, to make more laws, to make you less free. That is what they're hired to do. To make you less free. I can't put that more plainly. That is their entire job description. They just don't say it that way. But it is to make you less free, put more constraints on you. So in that sense, yeah, you want the least effective people possible. But I'm not going to support it in any way because I don't recognize the legitimacy of anybody to have any authority over me, because authority is a myth. It doesn't exist. All it is one person threatening another person.
Yeah, so I think we took that one apart. Basically, we're not in support of any of the candidates, not even the third and or fourth party candidates, which I think is we can talk about Gary Johnson a little bit and how he's a libertarian in name only.
Yeah, he's a lino for sure. And as the Libertarian Party itself is, I mean, maybe McAfee was a little bit more libertarian. In fact, he said the most best things, but I still had my issues. I mean, it sounds like you're a total NAP libertarian, anarchist guy. But what are you doing trying to become the leader of the most horrific state apparatus murder machine on the planet? It seems counter to what your message is. Johnson, yeah, he seems to be an empty suit that doesn't actually understand or believe in anything. He said a few things that are okay, like why should the government have any say-so on what I put into my body? It's absolutely true. Why should anybody have any right to say what anybody puts in their body? They don't own other people's bodies. You own your body. You can put whatever you want in it. So that's very much libertarian. But then he says that the cake, could you go over the cake thing real quick, Daniel?
Yeah, so this is a meme that's a Gary Johnson meme, and I have been having trouble finding it. I think it may have been scrubbed from sites on the internet because it's essentially Johnson sitting out the window of a car with a gun pointing at you. It says at the top, "Get in, Jew," and at the bottom it says, "We're baking cakes for Nazis."
So explain the history behind that for anybody that doesn't know.
So a big hubbub was made about a gay couple wanting to get a wedding cake baked for them in Oregon at a bakery who refused to do it based on their religious principles and not wanting to be a part of their, their marriage. And so they went whining to the government and sued this bakery, and it became a big deal. So people may be familiar with it. I'll find an article and I'll load it down below. But Gary Johnson was asked a question in a debate, where it was posed that, you know, okay, so there's this bakery and a gay couple, but let's change it to a Jewish bakery and Nazis who want the cake made. And Johnson said, yeah, you got to bake the cake. No discrimination. You got to bake the cake, which is so not a libertarian answer. And so that's why this meme is kind of funny. And I think because it mentions Jews and Nazis, it probably got scrubbed. So if I can't find it, I'll try to recreate it, and I'll post it below. But it just points out, you know, one of the many reasons why Gary Johnson is not a libertarian at all, other than in name or in party only. I think another thing he said recently was that Hillary Clinton has been a fine public servant. And so I just feel bad for people who are disgusted with both party candidates and are looking for an alternative. And of course, they're not all the way to where we are for maximum freedom. Right. But they're finding a libertarian in Gary Johnson and getting very, very mixed messages, and not a message that is what libertarian actually is or stands for, which is essentially the non-aggression principle. But what they're seeing is sort of a blend of Democrat and Republican, which is where Johnson is sort of positioning himself. He's saying that he wants to be a fiscally conservative, socially liberal person who will force Jews to bake cakes for Nazis, but allow you to smoke weed if you want to, which some of those things are sort of line up with libertarianism, but not really.
Right, but this goes to show you that he's a politician. He doesn't have a principled stance. He's like, this is a popular issue, I'll take this stance. This is the popular reigning issue, I'll take this stance. There's no guiding principle behind any of it. So the two things are absolutely contradictory. For on the one, you're saying that we own our own bodies, and on the other, you're saying, no, you don't own your own bodies. One, you have the right to own, you own your own bodies, you can put in whatever you want. On the other hand, you don't own your own body, I own you, because I'm going to force you to bake this cake for me. You can't choose to not associate with me if you don't want to. You have to. So I'm going to violently attack you to force you to provide this service for me, which is essentially slavery.
Yeah, free shit for everybody, right?
Yeah, right. So completely unprincipled, but you wouldn't expect, I mean, you don't go to politics for principles because the whole idea is contradictory. There's no principle guiding behind it other than I deserve other people's stuff, which isn't a – can you break that down into principle form? I don't think you can.
Yeah, indeed. Well, hey, I hate to
I don't know.
Cut this one short, but my wife came in here about a half an hour ago and said, wrap it up.
Oh, she is.
So we might need to end on the non-libertarianism of Gary Johnson, and I will try to recreate that meme because I think it is pretty funny, even though it might be offensive to some people. But, you know.
Who would it offend?
Yeah, I don't even know. Jews? Nazis? Social justice warriors? Bernie Sanders? Venezuelans?
Who knows? Who knows? But you won't find a principle. Look, if you can find one, let me know.
Yeah, indeed. So why don't we wrap this up? We sort of touched on the Matrix and the social control of the fellow prisoners, pouncing on people for having even a moderately dissenting opinion, which I guess would get them on the SPLC's hate group list.
Right. Absolutely. Sitting next
and
to you.
Utilitarianism and pragmatic arguments and how they don't hold water for the most part.
Not
and
when
Gary,
to,
Gary Johnson.
Yeah, right. Yeah, it was a good episode. I liked it. It's a little bit scattershot, but what are you gonna do?
Yeah, that's us, man. So hey, let's push some more of our shit. We've got the shirts, hoodies, the wife beater. We've got a mug, all with the Maximum Freedom or the Reed Rothbard logo. We've got the readit4.me website, and we've got which clicks through and gives us some bonuses, which is pretty nice. Anything else you want to mention, Robert? Any
are
the
we
work
still
that
on
you're
the
doing?
We saw the Amazon link or no?
Yeah, we got Amazon links.
So we can push. So, yeah, you can click on, you go readrothbard.com, you can click through to Amazon, and then just spend, buy whatever you want, like you would anyway, and then a small piece comes back to us, and it supports the podcast.
Yeah, I mean, we're out in the market, right? And anytime the market tells you you're doing a good job, you make a profit. And so far, the market's not really telling us a whole lot, but we're going to keep this up because, you know, we think it's important. And I think we're ahead of the curve. I think Murray was way ahead of his curve at the time. And I think that people will start to come around and seek out a couple of idiots who talk about this shit like us.
Right.
So you got an update on any of your work? I know you sent me some artwork. I need to post it below whatever episode that was, and I'll go ahead and do that. You got work on that first book or second book still?
Yeah, I got work on all that stuff. Just nothing to say except progress is going along. I'm thinking I've done a little bit more thinking about what I'm going to do to promote the book, and it might involve me purchasing. I can't believe I'm actually going to try to do this. This is just a bizarre idea for me. But I recently went to a show. It was a vaudeville show here in this little tiny little one-horse town that I'm in. And there was a girl there that performed with a ukulele, and she played a funny song, kind of like, God, what is that name? Who are those people? Those two ladies, they were on IFC a couple of years ago. Garfunkel and Oates, that's who it is. Anyway, kind of like those ladies, kind of like pulled like a funny song. Anyway, so I chat with her a little bit, and kind of got the idea to maybe do a funny promotional video slash song with me playing the ukulele, which would mean I'd have to learn the ukulele, which would mean I'd have to get a ukulele, which is just stupidly ambitious and probably shouldn't do it, but it sounds like the kind of dumb thing I might throw time and money at because I've got a decent idea for a song, and I've already written, I don't know, 6 or 7 verses for it. And so I don't know. I've got all this other music-making equipment, but here I am thinking about trying to actually play an instrument. Probably a bad idea. Might be a disaster. And you might never hear about this again, but this is what's going through my head right now. It would be a great promotional thing if I could do it right.
No, that sounds awesome. And because you've now mentioned it, you're never going to live it down. I'm going to bring it up until you actually do
great.
It.
Great. That's fantastic. I should never, ever say anything. I'll learn my lesson one of these days.
Indeed, sir. Well, hey, I think that wraps up this episode of the Reed Rothbard Podcast. We have been the Reed Rothbard Podcast. ReedRothbard.com, books, lectures, articles, this podcast, a bunch of merch you can buy now, and a bunch of other shit. So that's us, Daniel and Robert.
Reed Rothbard, Maximum Freedom.
Maximum Freedom, thanks for joining us.
Reed Rothbard, Maximum Freedom.
Reed Rothbard, Maximum Freedom.
Chipmunks. Chipmunk. We're the chipmunks. Guaranteed to brighten your day. Doot, doot. Doot, doot, doot. Doot, doot, doot.